Today is Thursday, November 26th, 2020. This is part three of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Keith and Nancy Green, G-R-E-E-N. My name is Tom Martin. Hey, good morning, Keith. How are you?
Good morning. Great.
Hey, happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, you bet. Same to you.
Yeah. Keith, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
You bet.
Thank you. We wrapped up part two in 1973. You had been working as a dishwasher, and then they made you the night, the kind of night prep person, and you quit. But you came back the next year in 1973, and they gave you a job housekeeping.
Right.
Can you describe what you did and where you did it and how that worked out?
Well, I actually was a housekeeper for a couple of years. Mainly, I was a houseman, they called us.
Okay.
And basically, my job was to keep all the maids supplied with sheets and towels and, you know, all their supplies.
Okay.
And I also stripped all the beds and got all the sheets together to send off to the laundry.
Okay.
And then put away all the sheets when they came back to the laundry clean. So.
Hey, Keith, at that time, was the laundry done at the South Rim or was it sent away?
It was done at the South Rim. There was that that one laundry building right close to Victor Hall. It was in that little complex where the maintenance yard was and all that stuff.
Okay. Okay. And then, so your job was to keep a central closet or central areas supplied, or would you actually have to lay the sheets and the pillowcases and the towels out in front of the doors by each room?
I had to take the sheets out and put them on the beds after they'd been stripped.
Okay.
But I also kept the maid supplied with a few, you know, so she got there before I did. She'd have sheets to make the bed.
Got it. So your job was to keep them going.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
Were they doing 16 rooms a day per person back then?
Yes.
Or was it 16 beds, 8 rooms?
No, it was 16 beds.
16 rooms. Okay, that's 32 beds. That's 16 bathrooms.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. It was hard to do. I mean, at times they didn't have enough maids, and so they'd make me a maid.
Okay.
And I had a really hard time. You know, I was always the last one to finish doing 16 rooms. That's a lot of work.
Yeah. And if you had to stock, I mean, if you were the houseman and trying to do, you know, the 16 rooms as well, that would be a long day.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, it was hard to do. Well, I think what they do is they have somebody, you know, maybe a houseman that was, you know, they just double their work. And then make me a maid. So I don't know. They're not called maids anymore. What do they call it? Rooming attendants?
Yeah, general room attendants or GRAs.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I had. I know the first year I was at Yavapai, and. Gosh, I don't remember his name, but there was this guy who was—he was a Hopi, and he always, and the person that was in charge of housekeeping was Carrie Musser.
How do you spell Carrie's name?
Boy, I'm not sure. I guess Musser.
Okay.
Anyway, yeah, she'd sit in a basement room at the El Tovar and smoke cigarettes constantly.
Oh.
That's what I remember about her anyway. And but anyway, I was telling you about our supervisor at Yavapai. He always called her the Great White Mother.
Huh.
So some message came down from Carrie. He'd say, "Oh, and the Great White Mother has this to say," you know. And
huh.
He was funny.
Huh.
And I think it was the second year, so that'd be probably 74, that I was permanently at the El Tovar. And that was a lot of work, too. That was before they had an elevator, so I had to carry all the sheets. They deliver them down in the basement, kind of over there, you know, by where the men's room is.
Yeah.
And they deliver them in big old crates there, and I'd have to carry them then from there on up to the third floor, sometimes second floor and first floor, for the El Tovar. So I mean, for the maids there.
Wow. Okay.
That's right. And I had my supervisor then was a woman, Mary Tomici was her name, and she was married to Gilbert Tomici, who was the bellman there, and the main bellman.
So hang on right there.
Okay.
Tomici, Tomichie.
Tomici. You know, I never saw any of these names in print, so I don't know. I think so.
What do you remember about Mary?
Oh, she was very, very kind, and you know, she was always. I remember one time, there was one of the maids that they hired was a woman who. Now, what was her name? Anyway, a woman who. She didn't wear underwear.
Okay.
And so every time she'd bend over to make the bed or something, she'd, you know, show her all together, you know. So Bridget, that was her name, Bridget. But anyway, so Mary was constantly whispering to me, "That Bridget, she's not wearing she's not wearing underwear again." But anyway, she was quite kind, and there was also Isabel, who was a maid. She always got the canyon end of the second floor of the El Tovar. She was always the maid for that wing, and she was also Hopi, and she and Mary would talk a lot, but they would talk to anybody. They talk anybody's ear off if you wanted to.
Hmm.
They were pretty fun people.
What do you remember about Gilbert?
Gilbert, well, remember, you know, there's all those little paintings and along the walls in the El Tovar that he drew. And also, you know, so he was somewhat of an artist. He was also... Seems like with the back door of the Bright Angel is all those bright polter colors.
Uh-huh.
And he painted that too. But anyway, I knew him for that. But really, you know, he was the bellman there at the El Tovar. So he'd stand right just to the right of the desk, the main desk there at the El Tovar. And, you know, in case he was needed for this or that or something else. But he was really funny because I, of course, course, would pass him constantly coming up and down the stairs. And he'd say things, he'd do things that would make me laugh every time. Like, a lot of times he'd put his right hand up and say, "How?" Like, you know, like he was Tonto or something.
Uh-huh.
Because he's Hopi, you know, but
yeah.
He'd go, "How?" Or, you know, something like that, you know. It was always pretty funny.
Just to help your day go a little easier.
Yeah, it did.
Cool.
It did.
So I just wanted some clarification here. In 1973, you were working at the Bright Angel. And then, did you stay? Did you stay?
No, 1972, I was working at the Bright Angel.
72 Bright Angel, okay. 1973,
I was mostly at Yavapai Lodge.
Mostly, house, okay. Yavapai.
But sometimes they'd assign me to Bright Angel, and I think I probably cleaned every single room on the south rim.
But between
sometimes even at Maswick, or it wasn't called Maswick then; it was the Motor Lodge. But
yeah, between 1973 and 1974, that winter, did you go home or did you stay over?
Okay. In 1972, 73, that winter, I think I got that wrong in our previous discussion. In 72, 73, I went back to Oklahoma, and I got a cataract operation.
Right, you talked about that.
Okay, and then 73... 74, then, was when I was, 73, that's when I hitchhiked out to the West Coast.
Okay.
And then, 74, 75, I believe I stayed there for that winter.
Okay.
I don't remember for sure. All that is much in my mind.
Right. I was just thinking at one point you would have stayed over. You would have been known enough and a hardworking guy, and they were like, "Well, we can use this guy through the winter."
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was kind of, so.
I think so, because I remember, you know, staying a winter at the El Tavar, so.
Okay.
You know, fixing stuff at the El Tavar.
All right.
One thing that I don't know if you want this or not, but we used, you know, one of the things that was kind of a funny little trick that we got into doing is every once in a while somebody would leave their panties
okay.
in their room, and you know that wasn't a stayover, and so we take the panties and we drape them over the horns of the elk, I think it is. It's an elk that is right there, you know, that you can reach from the mezzanine of the El Tavar.
Yeah.
We drape panties over his horns. So it always took a while before somebody would notice and they'd just go take it out.
Oh, my gosh. And Gilbert would notice, or somebody would notice and say,
"Somebody would, yeah.
Hey, go get those off of there."
Would take them down or not. He'd probably think that was funny and leave them there. But
what other things did you occasionally find in the rooms?
Oh, my gosh. Everything from cameras to pajamas to all kinds of stuff. All kinds of stuff. Things that people almost seemed like they were just trying to get rid of.
Oh. Huh.
And I later joined the YMCA, or no, not YMCA, not YMCA, the, what was that?
The Lions?
Lions Club.
Yeah.
I joined the Lions Club, and we used to sell that stuff, you know, it would it would be set aside, of course, as lost and found for a certain number of months, and then eventually it became anybody's property, basically, and so the Fred Harvey Company would let us take all that stuff and sell it in a big bazaar that we held at in the all-purpose room at the school, and that's where we made all kinds of money for scholarships and
right
helping people and that sort of thing.
When do you remember when that started? Was it going when you were working there in 74? Was that happening already by then?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know, because I wasn't a part of that at all.
Okay. But but when you joined the Lions, it was going.
It was going, right.
Okay. All right. So lots of things left in the rooms. Any other stories you remember about 74, 75, working as a houseman?
Well, I started to tell a story, and this is might morph into Ernie Kunzel stories.
Because, okay.
Yeah, I was at a party, and remember there'd been a fight in the Bright Angel Bar, and somebody in the process, one of the Rangers lost his radio.
Right.
And the radio then became, kind of contraband, underground contraband, and people were listening to it to keep up on police, what the police were up to, and that sort of thing. But anyway, somebody wanted to buy it. One of the Vert camps wanted to buy it, and the person who had it wanted to sell it. So Ernie had, and this would be in 73, I'm pretty sure. And Ernie Kunzel set up a transfer in the El Kabar parking lot at night, 8 or 9 o'clock at night, and it was, of course, a sting. So the guy that had the radio, you can just imagine him sneaking around between the cars and looking for this guy that wanted to buy it, the Vert Camp person, getting close enough to him to making the transfer, but not making the transfer, and suddenly Ernie popped up, freeze, and he had his gun out, and the guy went, whoa, and he turned and ran, he was running away from the canyon, and ran right over that edge, out on the, away from the canyon side, which is pretty steep too, down towards the train station.
Right.
And Ernie was actually firing his gun at him.
Wow.
In the parking lot. And he didn't hit him, so the guy got away. Okay, so at that same night was the night that there was a big party, employee party going on in the employee dining room at the Bright Angel Lodge. And me and my roommate, his name was Dean Zaharias, big old Greek sort of guy, American, of course, but anyway, he was my roommate, and we were like wandering home, pretty loaded, pretty drunk, and it was like a free keg or something like that at the party.
Uh-huh.
And went down the hill, and up towards the, we had a cabin in the motor lodge.
Okay.
They used those cabins for employee housing then. Those cabins, of course, aren't there anymore, but anyway, so we went and drank another beer probably when we got there and smoked a joint. And which, by the way, is legal in just 4 days.
Oh, right.
But it wasn't legal then.
Nope.
Anyway, so we smoked a joint and then basically passed out on our beds. And about maybe 2-3 in the morning, there was this knock on the door. And I had fallen asleep with my head on the foot of the bed. So my head was right next to the door, the cabin door.
Okay.
And I opened the door, and it was not Ernie, but another one of his rangers. I should remember all those names because they're so infamous in history, but I don't. Anyway, and he goes, is Dean there? And it turned out that Dean had, my roommate, had arranged the meeting between the guy that had the radio and the guy that wanted the guy that was a stooge for the Rangers, basically, to buy the ring, to get it from him. But anyway, Dean was the person who knew about it, so they came, and I said, Dean, and I yelled at Dean, and he finally woke up and came. And before he got up, the Rangers pushed the door open and came into the cabin and started searching. They were basically, they're supposedly looking for the radio. But, of course, they found the marijuana.
Right.
And so they arrested us both in... You know, I don't think I was even wearing a shirt. I think I was just wearing pants. But they arrested us and took us off to the jail. I didn't even know there was a jail at South Rim, but there was. Kind of, where was that? It was over by the maintenance yard. The one in the back, the one kind of back behind.
The yard.
Pretty sure where it was.
The yard anyway. Over by Albright, or the older one before that, over by kind of down near the Babbitt store, hitting that direction.
Kind of back behind where the school was.
Okay.
Back in that area, as I recall, anyway. It was just a cabin, but it had when you walked in, there was kind of a little hallway with bars on one side into one room, and you know, with a door, of course, barred door, and then there were some sleeping bags on the floor and a toilet in the corner, and they just threw us in there. It was a Friday night. And there was, and we weren't going to get arraigned until the following Monday. So I had to spend all day Saturday and Sunday in this one room jail with my roommate. And finally on Monday, they took us to be arraigned, and they decided to have us arraigned under the state charges for marijuana, because they were heavier than the federal charges, and you know, they meant more time in jail. So, which is just goes to show you how mean the Rangers were back then. Maybe they still are. I don't know. But anyway,
hey, Keith, I'm just gonna jump in for a little spelling here before we keep going, because Ernie Kuncel, last name is K-U-N-C-L. I think so. And Dean, would that be Zahariou?
Yes.
Okay, thank
Or
you.
maybe there's not, there may not be an O in there. IUS.
Zahriou. Okay.
Yeah, IUS.
Thank you. Okay, so at the park at the time, they had a federal magistrate. And
But they also had a justice of the peace.
okay.
And a justice of the peace was in that dealt with state crime, of course.
Oh, okay. So the justice of the peace would have been the one that you had to go because you were state charges, you weren't federal charges.
Right.
And who do you remember who the justice was?
God, no, I should, because he was an angel. Let me finish the
Yes,
story.
please.
So they bring us in. Of course, we're in handcuffs, and we sit in this office, and the judge is just sitting at a desk on the other side of the office, and he asked us, basically what had happened, and talked to the ranger. It wasn't Ernie, it was another ranger who was there. Well, it could have been Ernie too. I'm not sure, but anyway, and they said, okay, well, I'm gonna have, because we pled not guilty, and he said, well, okay, well, we need to assign you representation. They said, do you have any money? And we, of course, we're just minimum wage employees at the, at the park. So no, we didn't have any money. So we're gonna, the state was gonna have to pay for a judge, I mean, a lawyer for us, I guess. And
Right.
so anyway, he gave us this paperwork to fill out, and I, being blind, could not fill out the paperwork, of course, so Dean had to fill it all out. So Dean's filling it out, and I said to the judge, I said, hey, doesn't a law enforcement agent have to have a what's it called?
A warrant?
A warrant, right? Do they have to have a warrant to come in and search a place? And the judge said, well, yeah, he does. And I said, well, they didn't have a warrant. They just barged in. And he said, he turned to the ranger and said, so what do you have to say to that? And the ranger's like, as though he'd never heard of the Constitution, He was just like, I don't know, nothing. I get nothing. And so the judge said, oh, well, Dean, you don't have to fill that out. You guys are free.
Wow.
And they just let us go. We went, I think actually we had a party at our cabin, because it was, we'd gotten off for free. And then in the middle of the, or not the middle of the night, but later on that night, the Rangers showed up again and rearrested us.
Wow.
And this time they claimed that they had the right to come in because there was a guy whose last name was Dean who had escaped from jail in California someplace and was thought to be heading east. So they were claiming that they had the right to go in there because they thought Dean was that person who's, they had his last name and first name mixed up. Anyway, so we had to spend another night in jail, And then we went to be arraigned, and it was pretty funny because they were giving this information, you know, all this, quote, evidence, you know, that they kind of just made up to try and get us. And the judge wasn't paying, he wasn't even paying attention to them.
Huh.
In fact, I remember he got a phone call, and they were doing, you know, they were giving the explanation. He didn't even stop the proceedings to talk on the phone.
Huh.
And after they finished, he went, oh, this is all pretty serious information. But he did, we did have to submit some paperwork, but he let us go, you know. But we did have a lawyer submit some paperwork. We had to do that. But anyway, we got out.
How were you able to keep your jobs? I mean, I know it wasn't your fault, but you basically hadn't shown up for work.
Well, I don't know exactly, but we were innocent, so
right?
They couldn't really, you know, they couldn't really fire us.
Okay. Great. 'Cause
yeah.
I think, you know, you get thrown in jail, you might lose your job too. Even if it wasn't your fault.
Right.
And what happened to the radio and the guy who was trying to sell the radio?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I don't know what happened there.
Were they ever able to, you know, grill Dean Zaharias for his role in you know, connecting up this radio up for sale?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so.
All right. Huh. So it sounds like what I hear about Ernie Kunzel is he was really hard on employees, just like you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
But that if you had something wrong with you, you broke a leg or something was wrong, he was the medic everybody wanted.
Huh, yeah. That's probably true. Was he the chief ranger?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question.
I'm not sure if he was or not. He might have been.
I don't know.
Well, the things that I remember the most about him is that he would dress up like a hippie and hang out at the Bright Angel Bar and try to make drug connections.
Okay.
He had even wore what do they call those sparkly things, you know? And he had this long hair wig that he'd wear and bell bottoms pants and anyway, yeah, he'd sit at the bar and he'd try to talk people into selling him drugs.
Played the part.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. But everybody knew, of course, who he was, or else warned him about it.
Right.
And or warned people about it. You know, I don't know. He may have gotten some people that way. He also used to, you know, I was talking about the cabins at Motor Lodge. The cabins ran kind of between the road that goes straight back from where the lodge is today. They were between the road and the railroad track.
Okay.
And Ernie would, you'd often see him, you know, sneaking around back there in the weeds before you get to the railroad tracks, looking in the back windows of all the cabins, because the cabins didn't have curtains on the back windows. So, so he was, you know, he was a pretty evil guy.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
As far as, you know, unless you believe that people breaking the law be thrown in jail.
I'm curious, how did the marijuana situation work? Do you know how, you know, did somebody have a friend or something down in Phoenix or somewhere else and say, hey, you know, here's some money, send me some dope, and then I, you know, everybody would share it out? How did that, do you know how that worked?
There were all kinds of connections. It isn't like there was just one source.
Okay.
There was all kinds of stuff going on back then. And, I mean, you got to remember that was back when most young people were smoking dope.
Right.
I'd say half of the young people were smoking dope. But it seemed like everybody was smoking dope. And not just smoking dope, but also doing acid and mescaline. And, you know, it was the culture back then.
Yep.
The young culture. And so people would come, they'd be hired, and they'd bring maybe a pound of grass with them and sell it along the way, or sell it to when they got here,
mm-hmm.
you know, that kind of thing. So there are all kinds of sources.
Okay.
It wasn't like one person was the way that all, I mean, there were some people that got into, you know, they had connections down in Phoenix or Tucson that where they could, you know, where they could score maybe a pound of pot or,
mm-hmm.
or something, but you know, and sometimes they got arrested, you know, they got found out by Ernie and then of course arrested and sent off to who knows where, but
right.
But okay. usually you know, they could be successful. You could make a lot more money selling dope than you can working for minimum wage, that was for sure.
Right. Or a little less than minimum wage. Yeah. So you were rooming with Dean and
mm-hmm.
working as a houseman.
Right.
For that.
But when I came back in 75, okay, you know, when I started working as a houseman, I would get 2 days off a week, most weeks anyway. I would get 2 days off a week. And so I started exploring the canyon in a lot more methodical way, and got to know the people down at Phantom Ranch.
So you'd have 2 days off. Would you mm-hmm. would you take off as soon as you got off work?
Yes.
Okay. Where would you try to get down to camp for that night?
I think I would go, if I was going to Phantom Ranch, I think I would go all the way down and spend the night there. You could make arrangements to stay in what now is dormitories, but back then they were called the tent tops.
Okay.
They were called that because when you went in, there was a really nice porch on the outside, as you came in, but with screen all around it. And then if you walked on through the door, there were 8 beds in a room and the room had a canvas ceiling. And so that's why they're called the tent tops.
Huh.
But interesting that when they tore those down, it turns out that there was also canvas between the inside and outside wall on the sides and the back of the building. And so they were actually tents that had been built on a platform and then later covered over by wood and a roof.
And framed in, wow.
Yeah, it was just, they were built by the Civil Land Conservation Corps, so.
1930.
Sure, you know, I don't know how it progressed, you know, exactly how it ended up, but, you know, when it got covered over, you know, when the tents actually became buildings, but.
So you could make arrangements to stay there. Oh, so you wouldn't need to carry a tent. You wouldn't need to carry much in the way of bedding.
Right.
So your pack would be pretty light.
Exactly.
Nice. Exactly.
So it seems to me like I must have come all the way down there in one day.
Okay, and then
one afternoon, one evening.
You could spend a day there and another night, and then hike back on what was your second day off.
Right.
And then report for work the next day.
Exactly.
Okay. This is a 75. Who was the first person you remember meeting down at Phantom?
There was a woman named Alice. I don't remember what her full name was. And a guy named Chris, who was Alice was a cook, and she was one of those kind of what you think of when you think of a cook. She was a little bit overweight and very jolly, and you know, no problem, and you know, oh sure, whatever you need, we'll help you, you know, whatever. So I remember her. And Chris was, I used to help him wash dishes. And back then, there was no dishwasher. I mean, no machine dishwasher. There was three sinks, basically, and a garbage pail. So you scraped all the dishes off in the garbage pail and threw them into the first sink, which was the wash water, and they were also really hot. They had to be a certain temperature, and so we had to wear these thick rubber gloves to do it.
Yep. But
anyway, so the first one was the wash water, and so you'd wash it, you know, that'd be where usually Chris was, and he'd wash you know, basically a swipe or two with a brush, and everything's off of it, and then he'd throw it into the second sink, which was the rinse sink, and then I had to pick them out of the rinse sink and put them in the third sink, which had the Clorox in it.
Yep.
So it sterilized all the dishes. So, and then I'd pull them out of there and put them on a towel. And when I got a chance, dry them off, and then stack them up, and then when I got a chance, I'd put them in the correct cabinets, you know, wherever they belonged in the kitchen.
Cool.
But the fun thing about it was that we had this little record player down there. It was one of those probably costs about $29.95 or $39.95 if you bought them these days. But it's just like a record player and then two speakers that kind of opened up on either side of it.
Okay.
And that was it. And anyway, he put on bluegrass music, which, you know, has a good strong beat. And He'd blast that. He'd blast that. We'd have that to the right of the, you know, on the counter to the right of the dishwasher, and we'd blast that, and it got to be quite a quite a an operation, you know, him washing and me drying. And anyway, because I would help, I got, you know, lots of kudos from the staff, you know, which really wasn't very big. I think there's probably only about 7 people in this old staff of Phantom Ranch back then. And then, what was his name? Glenn Hogue. Glenn Hogue was the manager.
Hogue?
Hogue, yeah. I
Okay.
think so. Anyway, so I got to know him too, and eventually then, in 1975, I think I started again on the South Rim, but he offered me a job if I wanted it. And of course, I was hinting around all the time that it would sure be fun to work there, et cetera. But he was hinting around, and I said, yeah. And so he hired me as, but he, all he would let me do, because of my vision, all he would let me do was laundry. So I was the permanent laundry person for at Phantom Ranch in
And that would, I would think
1975.
that was a good idea because you, your eyesight might not have been good enough for you to wash dishes to see that everything was off the plate or clean something somewhere because you might miss that it wasn't clean. Was that, I mean, does that, is it, was that kind of how he was, might have been thinking?
That's how he was thinking.
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't how I was thinking, but it was, you know, this, you know, comes back to another theme in my life, which is basically the discrimination that you have to deal with if you have low vision. And afterwards, I had the next manager was Terry Mache, and she was willing to let me do everything. In fact, I even cooked for a while.
So Terry Miche was, did she go by Magda?
Yes.
Okay.
No,
What
she
do
did
you?
later. Not when she was at Phantom. I think at Phantom she always called herself Terry, but
Okay, MICHAE.
Michelle?
Yeah.
MICHAE. Again, I never saw, I can't remember it in writing. MICH Nancy Wood. She's not here, so I don't know. Michelle.
We'll just for a placeholder, we'll call it MACHAE, but I'll be able to look that up. What do you remember about her? And how did she become manager? Was she working there and then Glenn left and she was bumped up into that job?
Well, do you really want to know?
Yeah.
She slept with the general manager, who is Bohannon, I think. She slept with him and to get the job.
Okay.
She was, it's, which is funny because she's actually was gay. But she slept with him in order to get the job, so he put her down there, and she also had a girlfriend, Linda, anyway, who they also hired. So the two of them were down there, and
Okay.
then but
So
anyway, that's how she got hired. What I remember, well, she turned out, you know, ended up being a really good friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a few hikes together. I remember one time hiking up Phantom Creek all the way up to the confluence with the, or it's not really, what would they call it? Anyway, the place where Haunted Canyon and Phantom Canyon come together.
Okay, that's a ways up. There's some big pools you had to get through. And
mm-hmm.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, there's a, actually, there's a waterfall that you have to climb up the side of the waterfall in order to get over it. It's probably maybe 20 feet up.
Uh-huh.
But there used to be a rope that probably the CCC or somebody had, you know, had anchored into the wall up above and down below. And it was pretty amazing climbing that rope, because, of course, you had to be sure and push your body out away from the wall, so you can basically walk up the wall and pull in rope with your hands to get to the top of the wall. It was pretty fun, but and it was there for most of the time I was down at Phantom, but the Park Service eventually decided it was way too dangerous, and so they, instead of making it better, they just took it down.
Right. Right.
And so now you can't get up there that way. You have to go over Utah Flats.
Out and around. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so you were given the job of laundry. What did that entail?
Well, it was really similar to what it was on the rim. It entailed... the first thing I had to do is go around to all the cabins and strip all the beds that had been used, and you know, throw the blankets and the unsheathed pillows in one pile, and then there was a certain way to throw the folded sheets across the bed. It was pretty cool at Phantom. They had a, because all of the beds were, at that time, were bunk beds. And so there was a certain way that that two people could make a bunk bed. You know, if one person tried to make a bunk bed, they'd get dizzy having to run around it so many times.
Right.
But with one person on either side, and the sheets had to be folded a certain way. But basically, you just, each of you would grab, if the sheet was thrown across the bed right, which was my job, you know, throw the first sheet anyway across the bed, and then the second sheet was hung over the bedstead.
Okay.
But it was thrown so that you could just grab the top of the sheet and the bottom of the sheet, and then spread your arms out, and there the sheet was right there, and then tuck it in and throw the next sheet over like that. See, so, and also the, you know, you tried to have the blankets in such a way that you know, that they would be easy to figure out too. And
okay,
anyway, so you go around and strip all the beds and that needed to be stripped, and replace those sheets with fresh sheets, clean sheets that they would open up and they'd put on the bed. So, and then I'd go around all of the cabins and see, there was 11 of them, or 10 of them, no, 11 of them. There are 11 cabins, so
okay.
I had to do all 11 cabins, and then I'd come in into the laundry. Oh, first I'd have to start the rags, which were kitchen rags, and they had to be washed with really strong detergent, you know. But anyway, I'd start those, that load going in the washing machine before I went out and started stripping beds. And
did you have a some sort of like a little cart or a little wheelbarrow or something, or were you just walking back and forth from the cabins to the laundry machine with big bundles of laundry in your arms?
I believe it was the wheelbarrow.
Okay.
I carried it all in a wheelbarrow. Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
And
so you'd load the wheelbarrow up with laundry out of the 11 cabins.
Mm-hmm.
While
and then, you know, I don't remember exactly how it went, but you could just do so many cabins, and then you'd have to bring the dirty sheets back. And
right.
Usually by then you could start a load going in the washing machine and throw the grease rags that had been washed in the dryer, and then off again to get the rest of the cabins like that.
Who did the maintenance on those machines?
Roy Starkey.
Roy Starkey.
Yeah.
What do you remember about Roy?
Roy was a cool guy. He was he seemed ancient to us at the time, but he's probably a lot younger than I am now.
Huh.
He was in his 40s or 50s probably. He had worked for USGS as when they used to have there was a cable that went across the river. That cable may still be there. Went across the river.
Right, the Phantom Gauge.
Huh?
The Phantom Gauge, the USGS gauge, where they would go out.
This is before the gauge.
Well, the gauge was a little cable and a little collar on it, and you'd go out and drop off your collecting bottles and collect bottles of the river sediment water take it all back and then boil off all the water and weigh the sediment, and it was a lot of work every day.
Right, several times a day.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not the cable that was right next to the Black Ridge, not that cable. It's a cable further down. It's over, well, it's over Roy's Beach, if you know where that is.
Right.
Beach. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, you're right. Yeah, it was just basically a wooden box that he'd sit in.
Right.
And the cable was this kind of crimping tool, or had this crimping tool on it that you kind of kept over your shoulder, on your shoulder, and then when you needed to go, if you're going uphill anyway, you'd push it forward and then pull back. It was kind of about the size of a giant pipe wrench.
Right.
And you'd pull back, and it would crimp the cable, and then you could pull on it, and it'd pull you another yard up the cable.
So it would slide the cable back and forth. Now, when the USGS made all that electronic, Roy would have been out of job. Did he see that coming and decide to start working for Fred Harvey then?
I'm not exactly sure how all this worked, because it was all, no, it wasn't before I was working there, because when Glenn was there, Roy was still working for the USGS.
Okay.
I'm not exactly sure.
So maybe Roy was moonlighting.
Yeah, I think so. That could be. The cable, because when they put, of course, when they replaced him, they replaced him with this thing that was like broadcasting to a satellite.
Right.
All of the statistics and, you know, and then the satellite broadcasted all the Reston, Virginia, I think is where USGS's main office is, and that's where all that data ended up. But yeah, he was, I think that what had happened, I think he started doing, well, I think he was doing that anyway, doing maintenance stuff at Phantom Ranch, and just to earn his keep.
Okay.
And eventually, it was Terry Mache that got him on the Fred Harvey payroll, and then he was working for Fred Harvey, but he was the maintenance guy. But if it was serious maintenance, if it was like, you know, like if the walk-in freezer broke down, for example, they'd have to call in people from the rim and fly them down to get it worked on.
Okay.
Yeah, but he was, you know, keeping the ditches clear and there were a bunch of things that he did, you know, probably more than any of us knew, to try and keep things running well, changing the screens on they were all swamp coolers back then.
Oh, okay.
So that had to be done every spring.
The pads, example. Those kind of wood fiber in
right.
Cloth pads.
Yeah, Excelsior they used to call it. I don't know what that is exactly, but yeah, that's what it is, kind of wood shavings, but it's all kind of woven together.
Yeah.
Sheet. Yeah. Yeah. He used to have to do that and stuff like that.
Okay.
I mean, he was always there, of course, and so if anything went wrong, the manager could go, "Hey, Roy, can you go look at such and such?" And usually he could fix it, but he definitely didn't have the kind of expertise that a full-fledged maintenance person would have.
Right. Did you ever visit with him? Did he ever tell you any stories about where he was from or some of his experiences there at Phantom?
He didn't talk about his history much, but yeah, I talked to him quite a lot. In fact, he talked a lot about the history of Phantom Ranch. So,
nice.
Well, for example, before they put the electric line, before they buried the electric line that goes down there.
Yep.
That's buried under the Bright Angel.
The Bright Angel Trail. Yeah.
Yeah. Before that, he told me all about the generator. And the generator shack was still there when I first started working there.
Ah.
It was a big shack with screening all around it and with a generator in it. But, of course, it wasn't being used in 1975. But
right.
When I... but anyway, he'd talk about, you know, how it used to, how it used to, when it was running, it would run, it was like it had a governor, they called it, that made it stop, made it so, you know, if the flywheel, it had a flywheel, and one piston engine, and the generator would, and the engine would miss a beat every few beats because it had the flywheel going too fast, and then when the flywheel slowed down, it was too slow, then it would start chugging again. So
okay.
You had this chug, 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 and then it would stop a while and then start again chugging. It was loud enough that it could be heard pretty much all over the inner gorge.
Wow.
That
must have been obnoxious.
Yeah, you would think. you would think, but it was, and then they would shut it off every evening at 9 o'clock. So depending on what you were doing, pretty much everybody had to be in bed by then. But if you weren't, you know, everything went dark.
So. You needed a candle or a flashlight or something.
Yeah. Apparently before that, before they had that, see, these are old stories that Roy would tell me.
Cool.
Before that, they had was kerosene lamps.
Okay.
So you had a kerosene lamp to light at night, but after the generator was put in, you didn't have to light the kerosene lamp unless you wanted to stay up longer than the 9 p.m.
Right.
However, the generator wasn't all that reliable, and so often everybody'd be having a great old time after dark, but before 9 o'clock, and suddenly there was too much load on the generator, and it would stop.
Hmm.
And of course, that threw the whole ranch into darkness.
Right.
And somebody then would have to get out a flashlight and find their way to the generator shack and, you know, whatever it took to get that machine working again. It would, and then once I got it working, of course, then everything would light up again.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Okay.
But anyway, you would talk. He would tell stories about that sort of stuff, you know. And
cool.
Oh, I remember him talking about one time I walked with him down. We were walking. We just did a hike, a small hike, you know, down across the Silver Bridge and then along the river trail over to the Black Bridge. And right before you go into the tunnel on the Black Bridge, he showed me, he said, come this way. And we, you know, climbed on the scree rocks beside the tunnel, on the outside of the tunnel, and went around the side of the tunnel and found a pathway and walked on that pathway for about 5 yards or so until we got, and there were these, he showed me the things in the wall, you know, to tie the loops that were installed into the rock wall.
Oh, the anchors for the very first bridge.
Yeah, and then you come around the corner and you're under the Black Bridge. The Black Bridge is maybe 10 feet over your head.
Cool.
And you're on a platform, and that's where the 1921 bridge used to come to.
Right.
But anyway, he showed me all that stuff, and then he told me the story about Bridie, when they were filming the film, Bridie of the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
And even though in the film it says, you know, no mules or no burros were heard in the filming of this film, Roy said that they killed two burros pushing them off that edge.
Oh, wow.
Because there's a scene, of course, in the movie where Bridie is in the river. And, you know, remember, I don't know if you've remember that movie, but
no.
he was in a contraption that was supposed to take him across the river, but it fell apart halfway across, and Bridie fell into the river. That's part of the book and the movie and
the story.
And,
yeah,
and so Bridie, you know, swims to shore, but it took two burros before one finally swam to shore.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
According to Roy.
Okay.
But, you know, but anyway, he was full of all kinds of stories like that about the history of Phantom and
cool.
The swimming pool, for example. He'd talk all about the swimming pool and what that was like.
You know what? Let's we've been going a little over an hour here. Let's call it good here, and then we'll pick it up again, and we'll talk about the swimming pool.
Okay. Okay.
All right. Well,
I have to be careful with the swimming pool because of that guy Corny doesn't like it.
Well, you tell your story, and he'll tell his, and the historians will figure it out in the middle somewhere.
Okay. Well, all I can tell, you know, the stories I tell are the stories that Gail Bierak used to tell me and that Roy Starkey used to tell me.
Right.
You know,
right.
They're, in my mind, that seems more like the truth than what Corny says these days. But
well, that's, again, that's how it works, is oral histories are only a part of the historic record, and they're fallible, so we have to be a little careful.
Can you get sued for saying things?
Nope, you can't. But historians are warned, you know, be careful to not just write the history based on oral histories. If that's all you've got, okay. But if you've got letters or you've got park records or things like that, you know, you combine it all together.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, cool. Okay. Well, with that, this will conclude part 3, Oral History with Keith and Nancy Green. Today is Thursday, November 26th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin, and Keith, thank you so very much.
You're welcome. It's really enjoyable to talk about old times.
Cool. Hang on.